Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
And welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. More information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Bill Brown will be telling us about his experiences with blind bowling. So, can you tell me a little bit about blind bowling?
Yeah, we have blind bowling. Works is that we have 12 blind and visually impaired people who bowl each week, and we put a rail along the left-hand edge of the bowling lane along the gutter, and you use that as your landmark. If you take your steps like a regular person would do in bowling, then you put your left hand on the rail, take your steps, and then throw the ball. Some people prefer just to be squared up with the lane and throw the ball, and some others have their own little special way that they throw the ball. We have volunteers that tell us what pins are down and line people up. Like, we got quite a few of the 12, about half of them are totally blind and need a little bit of help to get up to bowl, because there's a step you got to go up and then you get yourself organized and bowl. We have about half men and half women, and the ages that the people are covering that participate in our bowling league are from the middle 20s to the 90s, so that's pretty big span, and all the way through it. Some 50s, some 60s, so it's there's no age restriction of any sort, and people can, if they want to bowl, they just contact us, and we put them on the list to bowl. We have two new people bowling this year. We're going to start bowling on the 5th of October. We were originally going to start on the 7th of September. We usually do start in September. But with the COVID and all the rules out here in Alberta that have just changed, and we set it back a month. So now it's going to be the 5th of October. So that's a little bit about how the league goes. As I said, we've been running it since the year 2000, and we started out with four bowlers. I worked for CNIB in Eastern Canada in Hamilton, and I'm from Alberta, so my wife and I came out here on holidays in 99, and she loved it, so we decided to move out, bought a house and came out here in 2000.
So
we went to the CNIB and asked them if there was a bowling league, and they said, well, there used to be, but there isn't anymore. And it just, the people who had been running it, I think, just probably got tired of running it and stepped aside. So anyway, we got started with four people, and wasn't long until we had 8 or 10, and we've run anywhere from 12 to about 16 each year.
So, curious, how does the league reach out to the blind community to let them know that this is available for them?
The Coffee News, and it's a free magazine that's all over town. And we use it to let people know, and of course, a sighted person in the family would have to notice that there is bowling for the blind and visually impaired, and they would then tell the person, and they would phone us, and we would set them up to bowl. Now, we provide transportation to and from the bowling alley. We have volunteers that pick everybody up, and after bowling, take everybody back home. That's probably because the greatest thing that has made our bowling league the most successful is the fact that we got transportation. Because I'm sure you've heard lots of times that the biggest issue blind and visually impaired people have is transportation. And so that resolves that issue. When CNIB had an office here, and they did have a small office here when we first started to bowl, and they were pretty good at referring people to us, and then we would contact them and just to find out if they'd like to bowl. Now, CNIB no longer has an office in Lethbridge, so it's much more difficult, and we have to depend on word of mouth. We depend on, there's a couple of sports organizations in Lethbridge that do have some sports for the disabled, and they are aware of our blind bowling league and will make referrals if somebody talks to them about where can I possibly be able to bowl. And so those are the main areas that we've used to recruit new people for the bowling league.
So, in your time with the league itself, is there any success story that stands out for you?
You know, we have quite a few success stories, but I would say one, there was a young girl that came to bowl with us, and she would have been about 18, 19, just through school. And, you know, wasn't very socially adjusted to the community at all. And by participating in a league where the other people were visually impaired as well, in over a period of about 3 years, it just made all the difference in the world. And this young lady, by the, you know, after about the 3 year period, she was just a changed personality. You couldn't believe it unless you were there to see it. Another story is a young boy who's visually impaired and autistic. And when he first came, he was pretty afraid to participate, kind of skittish. And his mom used to come with him. And then we talked to the mom and just suggested that we could get him picked up. And I'm sorry. And he would be able to bowl without her there. She was quite controlling. And once she was out of the picture, this young man developed like a gain like you would not believe. And today, he's just as outgoing as anybody at the bowling alley. And it's just amazing at the change that's taken place in this young man.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need for programs such as this and inclusion in sport, what would you say?
Well, there are very few opportunities for the blind and visually impaired in any sort of sport activity. We do have a Sports and Recreation Association for the Blind, and they do have quite a few people that work with them, but they're a much higher level of competition. They're training people for the Handicap Olympics and stuff like that, and that's where their efforts are. So they don't do very much for the average person who just wants a recreation. Now, the only other recreation that we've had in Alberta is, in addition to bowling, is curling. And it's amazing. One time we had a curling league in Edmonton and Calgary. We had teams, and they used to curl. And they're the main two. Now, in school, they do play a game called goal ball. And goal ball, you'd have to look it up because it's a little bit complicated to explain it all on the phone what it is. But it is a great game and lots of exercise, and it's a great sport, too. But in Lethbridge, where we are, certainly if there's any goal ball, it's being played in the school.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, Harut Markarian will be telling us a little bit about his accessibility work in terms of robotic design. So, can you introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about your accessibility work?
So, my name is Harut Markarian. I still am an aerospace engineer. I have a robotics master's degree. In 2014, when I graduated my robotics, I was working on a brain-computer interface project that helped a completely paralyzed person propel his wheelchair through his thoughts. And I thought, oh wow, that is really cool. And that was the first time I really wanted to start a company in robotics to serve the community of people with disabilities. And I did nothing about it till 2018, when my grandparents became, due to old age, completely dependent on caregivers, very limited mobility, if any. So I saw the struggle of the family, their struggle, both like physically, mentally, and emotionally. And one day I was carrying her from her wheelchair to put her on the couch, and because due to the stroke, her one part of the body was completely dead. So my foot got stuck between her legs, and we fell. So while we were falling, it was a very slow fall, and I was looking around for some type of sign to save us, because I wasn't going to drop her and I didn't want to fall with her on the ground. That's going to, hurt her as well. Luckily, there was a perfectly empty couch right next to me, so I grabbed all my weight and, pushed myself towards the couch. And luckily, we survived. I mean, there was no damages. It was then when I was like, okay, that's it. I'm starting a company, and I'm going to try to find solutions that is better than what we are doing right now. And I'm sure many other families can relate. If you are not someone with a disability, I'm sure you have somebody affected in one shape or form. So that's kind of where I said I started my company, Markbotics, and I wanted to provide additional level of independence to mobility challenged individuals through efficient and affordable robotic platforms.
So, how do you reach out to the disability population to let them know about your work?
So, the podcast was the main source initially, and I was lucky enough to have two really good mentors in Ben Stasko and Eileen Gruba, because when I approached them, I said, hey, this is what I'm thinking about doing, and I need all the help I can get because I know nothing about this community, So they were, so kind and generous enough to kind of educate me and bring me to their playing field, right? So I'm not using terms that is offensive. It's not because, I want to use those terms. It's because I don't know, So I'm learning. I'm learning what to say, what not to say. And I'm still learning. So the podcast became really the primary source of research in terms of me knowing what people need, and just get in touch with the community. And I built very good friendships, and that's how my first product was born. Really, after I interviewed a guy named Eric Anderson, And, you know, a few weeks after the interview, he came back to me and said, hey, man, if you do this kind of robotic thing, I think it will help a lot of people. And that's how my first product was born. And that's what I pride myself in. It's not the fact that I'm doing robotic designs. It's the fact that, you know, I'm collaborating with the community to find solutions together.
So what are some of the key challenges in robotic design for accessibility?
One of the challenges, I think, kind of obvious, is keeping costs down. Because there are a lot of great products out there, but if people with disabilities or the community, the majority of it cannot afford it, then we're not helping anybody, really. And I know this firsthand because another guest in my podcast educated me on where people with disabilities stand when they are living off of the government, right, the disability paychecks and all that. And she said, really, people with disabilities are living below the poverty line. And that was like something hard to hear, especially when she gave me the dollar value and she lives in LA. And I was shocked. I mean, how can people live on that amount of money, you know? And then I've seen all these products, you know, delivered to the market with $50,000 price tag on it, $20,000 price tag on it, and insurance is not covering it most of the time. So really, that became my niche, if you will, of serving people with disabilities with affordable products. Of course, I'm not competing with anybody with price because I'm just a startup and I cannot do that. They can eat me alive. But that was one of the challenges that I'm trying to face right now, keeping costs down to serve as many people as possible.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your designs and your work, what's been the greatest success in terms of innovation that would really provide support?
So when I was really researching, I had a really challenging time coming up with a product because I went to the Abilities Expo, I went to other trade shows just to see what's out there, what people are doing, because I don't want to duplicate, I don't want to compete, because I'm an inventor, so I want to create, right? And I want to create with the support of the community of people with disabilities and find solutions. So when I was doing my the robotic design, once the idea came from the community, really, or a few people in the community, I should say, it took me really 3 months to come up with a prototype. So there are ways of you know, doing effective things and cost-effective things. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I can't really say a lot about the product yet because the idea is the work.
If you could send any message to the community about the need for affordable and effective solutions for people with disabilities, what would you say?
I would say, hey, let's collaborate. Let's collaborate and let's find solutions together, because I'm offering my services, and I wanna really partner with you to come up with the next solution. I can't do it alone.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Hey, CGEM listeners. Looking for more ways to connect with CGEM programming? Try streaming CGEM through iHeartRadio. Listen online, download the iHeartRadio app, or use your smart speaker. Alexa, play CGEM on iHeartRadio. Experience CGEM FM on higher ground, no matter where you are.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex, who For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Bill Brown told us a little bit about blind bowling, and we heard a little bit about robotic design and disability from Harut Markarian. In this segment of our show, Joe Rizzuto will be telling us a little bit about special hockey.
So, can you tell me a little bit about your experiences with special hockey?
What experiences? I joined in 1994 with the Grand Ravine Special Program, where that was the year that Special Hockey International was formed. I joined with my son Mark, which was 8 years old at that time, and has Down syndrome. That was just after they came back from the first international trip with the Gateway Locomotives in St. Louis. And since then, I've been a coach, fundraiser, and I became president of Grand Ravine Special Hockey in 2003.
So
present.
So what types of disabilities do you most commonly see in this effort?
We have, SHI was meant for, it's today called intellectual disabilities, which in the past was developmental, and that's what we're working on. But we are moving forward and, you know, looking at different avenues for all other disabilities.
So, how do you reach out to the disability population to let them know that your work exists?
Through word of mouth, social media. That was the one problem. Not too many people knew of our organization. How SHI started was the gentleman by the name of Mr. Pat Flick started Grand Ravine Special Hockey back in 1980. We were the first team ever to be here. And a gentleman by the name of Tony Sansone, which is in St. Louis, read an article in February, I think it was 92 or 93, read an article on Grand Ravine Special Hockey, and he decided to put together an organization there in order to continue this special hockey program. He thought it was great, and he put together a team with some help with some people in St. Louis, and SHI was formed back in 1994.
So
go ahead.
I was just wondering, the sport itself, how is it different or similar than just regulation hockey?
Well, it's non-contact, non-competitive. We do not have winners. Everybody is a winner. We don't crown champions. We don't really keep standings at all. It's for the love of the game. We have all different ability levels. There's a high, a low, and it's mostly, I think hockey is the excuse. It's a social aspect of it that creates the atmosphere that we have.
So tell me a little bit about some of the training that's done with the athletes to get them started in the sport itself.
Well, we try to teach them the game as it's played. We do different drills, just like regular hockey, but understanding that sometimes their abilities will not bring them to a level of regular hockey, but to be the best that they can. So there is training. We try to do drills with them the same like everyone else. Try to make the game as real as possible.
So do you use any adapted equipment?
The only adapted equipment we use is the, it's called,
I forget, it was like a Zimmer or something. They're the plastic. They're made for just learn to skate. We don't use other adaptive equipment for them to play during a game, but it's on the learn to skate. We have some of those plastic that is CSA approved for them to learn to skate.
So, do you have any volunteers who work with the organization that have really made a difference in the effort?
Let me see. Can you reword that again, please?
I'm just wondering about the people that make the organization special.
The volunteers, they're all non-paid volunteers. They're in it for their heart. It's very rewarding of working with special needs. The slight accomplishment is the reward. And they all wear their hearts on their sleeves. They all try their best to have it as normal as possible, but with the understanding that some might never achieve the point of being so-called normal until, you know, they keep pushing to try them to get them to do it. But in a nice way, not where they're going to get them upset or, get them turned off the game.
So, in your time with Special Hockey, is there any success story that stands out for you?
For me, success stories?
Yes.
Is seeing the athletes who have never put on equipment, never put anything on, and trying a new experience, and once they step on the ice, they are completely changed after one or two practices. The other success stories is we have our organization runs as a mixed teams where all ability levels are on one team. We have 96 athletes with 5 teams. We're all mixed ability on each team. We play them, let's say, a low-functioning line, an intermediate line, and a high-ability line. And they play, we match lines. But the nice thing is, the success story of all that is, socially, they've grown up to be friends with each other. It doesn't matter the age gap. But they start to go out together, be friends, communicate. It becomes one big happy family. That's a success story for me.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Mm-hmm. I will.
My friends, disability in sport is a gift. But the fact is, when these athletes are out there, they're just enjoying themselves. They're just a part of the action, what's going on. They're not thinking about quote-unquote limitations. And they're still putting on a high-performance, enjoyable game. To get out there to cheer for an athlete because he puts on a great show is natural. But do we change our tune if we find out suddenly that athlete has a disability? No. We look at the game and we say, boy, that was a great match. Boy, those guys came together as a team. And that is the greatest gift in disability life. Or one of the greatest gifts, I should say. But the truth is, those athletes, for many of them, are coming out of acquired injuries, acquired disabilities. This can be an outlet by which they realize they still have strengths, potentials, and gifts in this world. And that can spill out into other aspects of their lives. Little by little, they come to realize they are still a person who matters. And if they have abilities out on the field, why not in other areas? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.